listening to the Colorado Springs Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by the Envision Advisors at Your Castle Real Estate.
Hey, Colorado Springs. This is Jenny Bayless here, and I am with Bill the Lender, Bill Rodriguez from Cornerstone Home Lending. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great, Jenny. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us today. We have been talking about this topic for a little bit now, and I think that it will be a really good opportunity to explore something that I think a lot of people just have a lot of mystery around.
Yeah.
And that's how to qualify for a conventional mortgage as a self-employed person.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot of confusion, and I'm not sure that there really has to be. I think as we go through the questions today, I think we'll talk about a couple of strategies that your listeners can really take hold of.
Yeah. And I think that it's really good for people that are starting their investment career. Maybe they're self-employed, just generally speaking. But then as people's investments start to take off, self-employment is usually a lot of people's goals to get to that point. Mm-hmm. But there's that little, you know, piece in the back of their mind that is worried that, hey, if I make this leap, I'm not going to be able to buy any more properties for a couple years or whatever that may be. Just, you know, we've all heard negative rumors about it. So yeah, just hoping that we can kind of dispel that and educate everyone on, you know, so that they have more information to base larger decisions off of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that any decision, as we'll sort of talk about it, it just requires some planning. If you're being proactive and including, you know, a good strategic lender in the conversation, they can help you avoid a lot of the pitfalls. And that's really, you know, the name of the game, right? Yep. Like, you know, as you expand and life changes and these types of things, you know, a lot of times you're making changes. You're not necessarily, they're not a mystery. You know that you're going to be eventually maybe making the leap into a self-employed, you know, opportunity. And so just having a couple of conversations could save you a lot of heartache and pain.
Yeah, I totally agree. So yeah, let's jump into the primary question. Why is being self-employed traditionally just difficult to acquire lending? And is it difficult to acquire lending? Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think just because you're self-employed doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be hard for you to get a loan. Now, there are some additional underwriting requirements. There is some additional documentations requirements that you have to sort of navigate, maybe. But if as long as you're proactive and you can avoid the underwriting pitfalls, I think one of the great things about your guys' team is that so much of your process on the front end is really all about discovery and understanding your client's unique financial situations, their goals, and you know, you can sort of get them in front of one of your lenders quickly so that they can have a really quality conversation, strategic conversation, you know, and avoid a lot of that upfront. You know, sometimes our conversations with our self-employed borrowers, depending upon the situation, and every situation is a little different, they're 12 to 24 months out, because you know, one of the things that we've seen, you know, with COVID was, you know, in 2020, that self-employed businesses, small business owners really took hit. And there may be a year where they just have a ton of expenses, like a lot of businesses did in 2020. Or, you know, most self-employed business owners, they're writing off the majority of their income to avoid paying taxes and really kind of maybe, dare I say, hide their lifestyle a little bit in the tax rules and guidelines, because they're able to do that. But when it really comes down to looking at it from an underwriting perspective, you know, we're trying to squeeze sort of every cent out of their situation to get them to qualify. So if you have a borrower that's maybe thinking about buying a home and they know that's upcoming, or they're thinking about diversifying their portfolio and jumping into the real estate game, having that conversation early and taking a look at how we can work with your current existing financial team, because we're not licensed tax professionals. So we're not giving advice, but we are experts in filtering a tax return through the current underwriting guidelines and helping people understand and working with their tax planner to, you know, line out their goals and then only pay the amount of taxes that they need. So they're accomplishing both sides of that coin. The first being, you know, accomplishing their their real estate goals and sheltering as much taxable income as we can, right? So that's a balance. And it's a little counterintuitive because tax professionals and mortgage professionals are diametrically opposed. One is looking to save every dollar they can, and the other is looking to squeeze every dollar he can find or she can find to get you where you need to go.
So what do you guys do in that case? Like, I imagine that there are certain line items that beneficial for from a tax perspective, for example, depreciation. I know you guys are able to back that out. What are some other common line items on a tax return that you guys are able to kind of eliminate when it comes to looking at someone's lending profile in a negative way for those expenses?
Well, you know, that's a moving bogey because you used to be able to write off meals. Now you can't. You used to, you know, you can write off mileage, you know, add back in, you know, 12 cents a mile. So you can do things like that. But a lot of times it really is just helping looking at the overall expense for the business and saying, okay, so you may just not want to take all those expenses.
Gotcha.
Right? So it may just be reducing the amount of expense that they're going to take so that from that planning perspective on paper, they look better. You know, I mean, a lot, and even sometimes when they've already filed their return, we've worked with the CPA saying, we need to really make this move, or, you know, our house is already, you know, on the market and we're, you know, we've got a post occupancy agreement, but, you know, or we're under contract on a new build and we need to make this work. So we'll work with our CPA to sometimes even file an amendment to the prior year's return.
Okay.
And help them not only prep for what they need, but also prepare for that potential tax liability. Because once you file, if you change, make any changes, then you're paying, you know, penalties and what have you, and interest on you know, stuff that you already claimed, right? You've already written off.
That's interesting. I was thinking it was more, I guess, mathematical or methodical, like, hey, these line items we can put back in. I didn't realize it was essentially a tax strategy that you have to balance the difference between the lending side and then the tax saving side. So that's really fascinating. And I guess, you know, a self-employed person would have to decide, what's more important to me this year, tax savings or getting this property?
Yeah. And, you know, that's why sometimes having that proactive conversation over a 2-year period so that you're graduating the income over time, right? Mm-hmm. You're not paying all of those taxes in that year and seeing a major liability. You're scheduling that out. You're looking ahead and saying, okay, so this is something that I know I'm going to do. Or this is something that I know I want to do.
Yeah.
And a lot of your clients are on the hunt and they're developing a relationship with you guys over a period of time. And it's around that 18 to 24 month time frame, if I'm right there. And so knowing that that's eventually something that they want to do, or even like knowing that they're eventually going to make a move. Maybe they're W-2 now, and they're going to, the employer wants to keep them employed, but doesn't want to take on the cost of their benefits. So they flip them over to a 1099 because they want to retain the employee. But now they're going from a W-2 position to a 1099 position. And that's an entirely, you know, different situation, because now you're an owner and now you have the ability to run your expenses through and filter that against your income. And from an underwriting perspective, we want, there's a period of time that we want to see you manage your business.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, I know that, like speaking personally, I went, as you know, I went from a W-2 to a 1099 over the past couple of years. And I just automatically assumed that I wasn't going to be able to get a traditional loan. And so, you know, just speaking from experience, you guys were able to sort of dispel my hesitation. And it was more of a pleasant surprise, since I went into it thinking that I wasn't going to be able to get anything. And to that, no, actually, you know, you qualify for XYZ. Oh, that's great. I was thinking zero. So,
right, yeah,
so no. That's great. Yeah. So having that conversation, I think, you know, just if you're about to leave your W-2 job by choice, I think it's good to talk to a lender as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, from that standpoint too, you know, I think people just need to understand that there's some pretty common myths around the time frame required,
mm-hmm.
and most lenders will say 24 months. And I'm going to let your listeners in on a little secret that it doesn't have to be that long. One of the unique things that Cornerstone has is called their production support team. And just like the name suggests, they're there to support production, which means that if you've got a interesting or unique or out of the box situation or a unique property or anything like that, this team is an executive level underwriting team that can make decisions even up to funding a loan that's non-sellable. So if you've got like a difficult situation, or in our case, we're talking about the self-employed borrowers, they can be a lot more sophisticated than your average borrower, because they've got money coming in from all different places. They've got different schedules. Depending upon their situation, it may need a deeper level of analysis. And a lot of times, other companies, the way that they sort of do things is they collect all the documentation and then it gets submitted to underwriting to be ratified, if you will, and that's where you kind of run into problems, because mm-hmm. you're not seeing what you should be maybe taking out of the underwriter's view, right? Or necessarily analyzing the tax return the same way and the income the same way that a conservative underwriter might. And this group of folks will pre-screen these types of situations, and they'll sign off on the income or approve the income and help you solve the income from a front-end sales perspective so that it never becomes a problem. And they will make exceptions in our case where we'll do, you know, and this isn't a hard and fast rule here. It's going to be an individual case-by-case basis. But, you know, we'll do self-employed borrowers with 16 to 18 months worth of history. Now, we like to see 10 to 12 months on a return, but that rest of the time could be made up in the current year with a year-to-date balance sheet and a year-to-date P&L, so that we can see that the cash flow remains strong and they're continuing to grow and expand the business and it's cash flow positive. And we'll do that situation, you know, particularly if it's got great credit, they've got some reserves, you know, they've got money down, they've got some what we call compensating factors. That's something that we can work with all day.
Is the two-year myth, is that like a Fannie Freddie rule? And then anything less than that, Cornerstone has to essentially deems it a non-sellable loan and has to hold it in in-house or?
Fannie Freddie, well, actually, it's really more of a cultural decision, underwriting decision, company by company. So if a smaller company has a lower risk tolerance, let's just say, they may go, you know, hard and fast at that rule as what we call an overlay. Because, you know, you can, you know, Fannie Freddie says you need at least one return. FHA requires at least 12 months. So you can do it, but people don't necessarily always elect to.
Okay. Gotcha. Interesting. Okay. So that kind of feeds into my next question is, what's the difference from a lending perspective between self-employed and W-2? Is it mostly risk-based? And if so, what are some of the compensating factors? Like you mentioned reserves, you know, and then obviously length of self-employment is a risk mitigator as well. So what are some other things that someone needs to be cognizant of?
So really, if you think about a self-employed business owner, they're assuming all of the risk, where like W-2, you're an expense to a business. Where self-employed, every employee that you have is, you know, a expense of the business, right? So as a self-employed business owner, you are line-iting everything that comes through the business, employees, payroll, any retirement, 401ks, those types of benefits all get subtracted from the bottom line, or we'll call it top line revenue. And so what's left at the end of the day, after all that is said and done, is what you have to work with, right? So it requires, depending upon the setup of the business, the personal return, the business return, balance sheet and P&L year to date. So a lot of additional documentation, where the W-2 is really seen as a single person. The self-employed business owner is seen as a single person and with the cash flow of the business, right? So it's seen as two things. There's the credit worthiness of the buyer and the cash flow and the health of the business. Whereas a W-2 employee is really the credit worthiness of the buyer only. And then we're only looking at the likelihood of the income to continue, right? So for a W-2 employee, where you get sometimes some additional documentation, might be overtime, might be if they're over 25% commissioned income. It could be bonus income. In those cases, if we're using that to qualify, well, first of all, if we don't have to use it, we're just going to leave it off of the application and just go with the base salary to qualify. We're going to make that, we have the ability to make that as easy as possible.
Sure.
Where with the self-employed business owner, we're going to itemize and line out everything that's coming through and leaving the business because we have to. So that really is the main difference, is one is sort of seen purely on their credit worthiness and the other one is seen on their credit worthiness and the health and cash flow of the business.
Okay. Are there certain self-employed industries that are seen from a lending perspective as more risky than others? Like ones that have, you know, typically like industry-wise, a lower expense ratio, or, you know, versus something that, you know, maybe is equipment heavy, capital intensive, that sort of thing. Do you guys kind of bucket things that way, or is it on a case-by-case basis always?
So the only industry that as an owner that we just won't really look at, and that's just because the federal mandates don't line up with state and local ordinances, is going to be the pot industry. Mm-hmm. So we can lend to a W-2 employee, but owners of pot-based businesses, whether they're creating the mechanics around the vaping pens or, you know, just the nuts and bolts around the actual product, or selling and distributing the flour or whatever it is that their business is a part of, we can't do those loans for the owners. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's purely based just on, you know, the bottom line, how much is coming in versus how much is going out. I don't care if you're sitting on a ton of inventory or you have capital expense related to equipment purchases. The only time that I care is if you're heavy in that year, then is that a one-time expense, which is also something that we could look at. You talked about depreciation. We can look at one-time expense in the same way, right? Okay. So if it's a one-time expense, I can show those receipts, explain what that is and why it's there. And like a capital investment in equipment, or for your investors, as an example, they're in acquisition mode 1 year. And so they're heavy on rehab costs. But the next year, now they're just looking at cash flowing the properties and they're not looking at that high amount of expense associated with the cost of rehab, then we can add a lot of that back in as long as they're not going to depreciate it over the life of the investment. Anything that's depreciated, I can't add back in. So if it's a one-time expense, it has to be labeled in that expense category and we can show what it is and we can add it back in.
Oh, so you guys don't add depreciation back in?
No, we do. We do add
depreciation. Oh, you do. Okay.
But if you're depreciating like the cost of a roof over the life of that investment, mm-hmm. I can't add that back in because you're taking it as depreciation.
Oh, okay. But you can add the depreciable amount for that year. Mm-hmm. So the 127.5 of that roof. Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. So yeah, a couple other questions that we had in regards to self-employment history. Does being in the same industry that you were previously W-2'd and then transitioning to self-employed, for example, the example that you mentioned where someone was working for an employer, then they transitioned to a 1099 contractor of that former entity, does that kind of help in the fact that they have an experience in that industry? Does that help at all from a risk-based perspective? Or does it just kind of start the clock over as soon as they become self-employed?
Well, from a job stability standpoint, it looks good. But you're still going to have a minimum of 12 months on a return so that we can see if they are writing off, because the assumption is now the employer's not going to pay for the cost of doing business. Let's say it's a mechanic. And now, even though tools are something that they always have to pay for, but now we're going to write off all of the costs of the acquisition for the supplies that they need to do their business and write it off as an expense against their income so they pay less taxes. So we just really need to see how that sort of lines out, because the tax return is generally regarded from an underwriting standpoint as the P&L of the business. So we have to have a P&L to be able to look at the health of the business. So yes, from a job stability standpoint, in regards where, because some people, they have a W-2 job, they hate their job, and they go off and pick a completely separate career. That actually is a bigger problem from that standpoint than being in the same position and just converting over to 1099, because now you have to substantiate your expertise in a new industry, right? And then run a self-employed business and show a healthy rate of return. So, there's always going to be that conversation of sort of what, and you could argue that in a lot of cases that they left one experience or developed a skill or learned something in one job and they're taking that because they discovered that they had a deeper passion about something else, but they took a skill and transferred it to the new position. You could develop a case for that and maybe get around it, but you're still going to need to show that you can manage a business. and having that 1 year on a return or 10 months on a return so that we can see that is going to make, it's going to substantiate that for us.
So kind of a tangent based on something that you just said, that you have to prove that you can manage a business. Does having ownership of rentals for several years and showing that you are optimizing their performance, does that help substantiate the fact that you are, you know, business-minded, business-focused, and help in any way?
Property management experience, yes, it does, actually.
Okay.
You know, it would be self-managed. You couldn't, like, as an example, there are plenty of W-2'd folks, customers of yours, that work the W-2 job, acquire rentals, and then have it property managed. Mm-hmm. They're not self-managing. And then they want to leave and retire from their W-2 job and become a real estate investor. But they still have to substantiate that with property management experience of 12 months, self-managed experience with 12 months in order to make that transition. Now, if they did that prior to leaving their W-2 job, then we could argue with the underwriter that they have the appropriate amount of experience. They developed that and there would be no interruption. Does that make sense?
Interesting. Yeah. No, that's very interesting. I know Chris and I have a, you know, ongoing debate as to self-manage or property manage. And here's a plus one for the self-managing people. So,
and, you know, even if it's just one.
Yeah.
Even if it's just one. So, and it's the self-managed, the second home, right? So you're doing all the bookings through your, you know, midterm rental, whatever, platform. You're managing that, right? If it's just one, and then the rest are then managed by a property manager, that still counts.
Oh, okay. So it's not like a ratio of, you know, if you have 10 houses, you need at least five of them to be self-managed.
You just need to demonstrate that you have the experience.
Oh, interesting. What if someone self-manages for, let's say, 2 years, and then, you know, on year four, property management, year three and four, and then year four, they decide to be self-employed. Could they peel back to when they were self-managing, show you those returns and everything and substantiate their experience that way?
That one I would need to check on. I think you could probably make the case, particularly because you've had self-employed Schedule E, a strong history of it. I think that it would be easier to substantiate if all those properties were, you had like a property management company that was in existence. That we could track back to with the Secretary of State to show that it was in existence back then. I think you could make an argument, but that would definitely be a conversation that I would have with my production support team. Be like, hey, do we feel comfortable with this? What do you guys think? This is what we have. And make the argument. But I think you could make the argument.
Okay. That's interesting. That was just a little tangent that I wanted to talk about based on something that you said. So from a lending perspective, I know we talked a lot about strategizing between taxes and mm-hmm. lending requirements. What is something else that someone can do to better position themselves if they're currently in a W-2 and they know that they want to become self-employed, but they have time on their side? What are some things that they can do to start preparing now?
Well, the first thing I would say is, like, you know, we have to dive into their situation specifically. So in the case that we talked about, the person who hates their job and they're going to a completely new industry. So in that case, then, and they have time on their side, that's a key phrase there. In that case, you know, they may really want to look at being in acquiring their primary or their new investment property while they have the W-2, because they know that they're at least going to have 16 months before they could substantiate, you know, a window that they're not going to be able to buy, right? So they may choose to acquire in the W-2 phase, make the transition, right? Establish their, you know, property management LLC or whatever, and then flip over to the self-employed, whether that's, you know, buying pallets of stuff from Amazon and reselling, and then supplementing that with their Schedule E income as an investor. So they still have the practical experience while they're, you know, they're buying their primary residence and they're self-managing their investment property. So they have that practical experience to make the transition into the self-employed realm as a real estate investor that's earning income and showing that they're experienced prior to making that shift into the self-employed. Now, if it's a situation where they are, and it also depends on what they're buying too, because, you know, a primary is easier to slide into than an investment property for your housing hackers, right? Because, you know, they're going now from doing that job, then being converted over to a 1099 employee doing the same job, they really only need 12 months on a return to be able to move forward in those situations under certain circumstances, FHA being one of them.
Okay.
To be able to make that transition. So really it's just is how much time, energy, and effort, you know, do you want to put into the planning process, and how proactive can we be in having conversations early? Because, you know, things are subject to change too. So checking in on a regular basis and making sure that strategy is still something that conforms with current underwriting guidelines is pretty important.
Is it worthwhile for that individual, just to go off your example, the person who dislikes their job and then they want to be a self-employed Amazon dropshipper. So could they do some business, you know, while they're still employed? That way it's still being reflected on their tax return. Mm-hmm. There, you know,
that counts.
Just
that
showing. Counts. Okay. Yeah. So that showing like
practical experience. So mm-hmm. maybe you're running it's your side hustle, right? That you're running concurrently with your W-2 so you can make that smooth transition. But it makes a lot of sense to put not, you know, take that side hustle as cash under the table, but fully report it so that you're showing a history, registering it as an actual business with the state of Colorado or wherever you are, so that you're substantiating the timeline of when it's been in existence, because that's where we're going to look. We're going to look at that this is an actual business that's registered, and then we're going to look on the returns to see if you've got any income and what that income's been, what it looks like. And even if you have, you're not banging down the door of $100,000, but you have profitable income over a period of time, you know, even if it's nominal, it still counts.
Okay. That's very interesting. So I think that would probably help a lot of people kind of in their planning, for that. And then, so going to the more negative side, what are some hiccups that you see as a lender when a self-employed file gets to underwriting, or even before underwriting that, you know, you mentioned your process does? Like, what are some things that is just, yeah, we cannot help you guys on this, other than, you know, some of the timing perspective, and I guess if they're bleeding cash flow on that. But what are some things more nuanced that people need to be aware of?
Losses. If you're taking, even if it's a slight loss, any business under 5 years, self-employed business under 5 years in existence, is they're going to take a conservative estimate of the income. So the current rule states, you know, if that income's declining more than 4%, 5% is the typical red flag zone for an underwriter, then we're going to use the lesser. So if that's declining from 2021 from 20, then we're going to use 21 only because it's less.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, if it's going up and let's say 2020 was $60,000 and 2021 was $120,000, to be conservative and speaking, we're going to average backwards for the 2 years over the 24 months. So it's going to bring that, you know, a lot of folks are like, dude, I'm banging out $150,000. My business is doing great. Why am I only qualified for X? Well, it's because, you know, in 2020, you only made $60,000. So that pulls that average down significantly. You're not going to be buying that $650,000 or $750,000 home because you can't quite afford it, you know, on paper.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that makes sense because, I mean, self-employed, you know, I have no idea how much I'm going to make in 2022. You know, you just, there's just really no way of predicting
that. You're going to kill it.
I mean, it's just, you know, as a lender, when you're giving someone a lot of money, that makes sense that you have to err on the conservative side, whether it's averaging if you're going the right direction or taking, you know, the lesser of the two, if you're not quite trending in the right direction. So that makes total sense.
I think most, you know, most new self-employed folks, they don't quite get that, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're new to their business and yeah, they worked hard and they feel like they've earned it because they're crushing it, right? They're crushing their goals. They're in that six-figure range and they're proud of what they've done. And then they're like, what do you mean? You know? So I think that's a little surprising for, mm-hmm. for some folks. And then the biggest thing is just like you not having a conversation early on. So we always follow up with our self-employed borrowers, even if they're not planning on making it doing something that we know of, we'll still reach out to everybody in December and January for their annual mortgage reviews and say, hey, just wanted to check in. Not sure if you're planning on filing now or if you're planning on filing in October, but you know, if you're planning on making any moves, we'd love to just sit down with you and, you know, make sure that you know what bogey you need to hit with your planner, your tax planner, so that if you want to make a move, you can.
Yep.
Right. And so, because, you know, once the tax return gets filed, it just gets increasingly complicated because now you're either amending the return and paying the penalties and fees associated with that, or you're stuck with what you got. So, and we would like to head any of that off at the pass as much as we can, right? Because, you know, we want to help.
Yeah, I think that is important to drive home. It's a two-way street for the conversation. You know, I think the borrower needs to be 100% transparent with what their plans are as well. That way you guys can give a stamp of approval before it gets too late. And, you know, time has been wasted and come to find out that it wasn't going to work out, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Because that's just, you know, disappointment that could have been avoided.
Mm-hmm.
And any time that we can help anyone achieve what they're trying to do and do it with ease, that's absolutely the better path.
Yeah. I mean, this was so enlightening. I didn't even know as a self-employed person what I was doing in order to qualify. Like, I know that sounds kind of ignorant on my part. Just kind of, you know, deferred to you all on that. So this was very, very helpful. And I think that it's going to help a lot of people either make moves or start a conversation with, you know, you or their lender to say, hey, what moves, you know, what chess pieces do I need to get lined up so I can do what I want to do? And it's nice to know that it's not as scary and as impossible as, you know, I think we all kind of have in our heads of how it's going to be. So I really appreciate you dispelling the myths and kind of helping people probably feel more at ease about their large life decisions that they might be thinking about.
That's what we want to do. We want to approach it from that consultative perspective. Absolutely.
That's great. Bill, how can people reach out to you?
You can always email me at B as in boy Rodriguez at houseloan.com. My website is www.rodriguezloans.com. And my cell is 303-877-6323.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Bill, for coming on and helping everyone learn the process. We really appreciate it. And we'll have you back on for a different topic some other time.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Take care.